Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. This is our first WFHB Community Conversation. I'm Doug Storm, host and producer of Interchange. Tonight's program on race and privilege is called A Backyard Conversation, obviously because we're trying to talk about the local here. So that doesn't need a lot of explanation, but I'll give you a brief outline of how this event came to be, and in the process hopefully show you by broad strokes what we're going to get into in detail tonight. If you saw our news release or heard our promos about the event, you know that topics to be discussed tonight include race, racism, privilege, policing, and with a special emphasis on the local. From Ferguson to Charlotte, a national dialogue is underway about the status of race and racism in the United States. What is the state of things here in Bloomington and other communities in South Central Indiana? Many suggest that racism is institutionalized within the United States and thus operates in ways both seen and hidden. This discussion seeks to interrogate our own community. About 6 months ago, I think, Jennifer Brooks, one of tonight's panelists, asked me if she could develop an Interchange episode on white privilege. Since neither of us exactly knew what that should look like, we set about doing what we always do on Interchange, looking for a national author to interview and maybe a local academic as well. But each of us kept finding articles and research essays about the subject that deepened our understanding, but also confounded a little bit of of what we thought white privilege meant and how we should approach it, especially as two privileged white adults. So this was the solution. We asked for help. We asked outspoken and thoughtful people to speak about these tensions. It's one of the problems that we seek to confront, that a white perspective is considered normative in the United States and thus by definition excludes perspectives from people of color. The narrative of protest has also been offered through this same lens. Media outlets generally report on disruption and inconvenience, and the clash of protesters with police or those who feel unduly affected by protests. What does our media obfuscate in our understanding of racism in our communities? Finally, there is a kind of response that we seek to address. Why are aggrieved protesters expected to be civil? We confront the legacy of slavery while being assured that slavery is in the past. Of course, when students at our North High School decide to come to school wearing the Confederate flag as capes, it should be clear to all we are not living in a post-racial nation. And the amped-up rhetoric of constructing a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico ought to make it plain that the political use of fear and hate will continue to create obstacles to our understanding. These are some of the questions and quandaries that led to the creation of tonight's event. We intend this discussion to be an honest exchange of ideas, and we expect, hope, for thoughtful audience input when prompted by the moderator. There are microphones down here you can see, so we'll have audience participation later. I'm going to introduce our moderator and our panelists now. Our moderator is sitting in the middle, Amrita Chakrabarty Myers. She earned her doctorate in U.S. history from Rutgers University, specializing in African American history and women's history. She's a historian of the black female experience, interested in race, gender, sexuality, power, and freedom, and the ways in which these constructs intersect with one another in the lives of black women in the Old South. Myers has been the recipient of several awards, including the 2012 Phyllis Wheatley Book Prize from the Northeast Black Studies Association, the 2012 Julia Cherry Spruill Book Prize from the Southern Association of Women Historians, the 2011 Anna Julia Cooper C.L.R. James Book Prize from the National Council for Black Studies. She's also presented her research at numerous venues, including the American Historical Association, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, among many others. Her first book, Forging Freedom, Black Women and the Pursuit of Liberty in Antebellum Charleston, was published in 2011. She's now at work on her second book, Remembering Julia, an antebellum tale of sex, race, power, and place, and is the Ruth Ann Halls Associate Professor of History and Gender Studies at Indiana University. Jennifer Brooks is a panelist. I'll introduce the panelists now. Jennifer Brooks grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, but became acquainted with Bloomington in the summer of 2006 as a student with the Summer Cooperative African Language Institute, hosted by Indiana University. In 2008, she accepted a job at IU's Center for Post-Secondary Research and migrated to the Heartland. In July of 2014, Jennifer began volunteering at WFHB as a board engineer in the News and Public Affairs Department. In January of this year, she became producer of Activate, a weekly feature of the Daily Local News that features interviews with local volunteers and activists. In the fall of 2015, she co-founded the local chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice, a national network that mobilizes white people to work for racial justice. Jennifer holds a bachelor's degree in history from California State University at Chico and a master's degree in world history from San Francisco State University. William Morris, down here at the end, is an attorney with Indiana Legal Services, where he works extensively in homelessness prevention and other areas assisting people struggling with poverty. William has worked in housing law and other areas of poverty prevention for over 20 years. He served on both the Bloomington and Monroe County Human Rights Commissions, and he's one of the founders of the Indiana Moral Mondays movement. Russell Moat is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies and the associate chair in the Department of Recreation, Park, and Tourism Studies within the School of Public Health in Bloomington here. His prior work includes serving as a city commissioner for the Champaign Human Relations Commission, program director for the American Friends Service Committee, field coordinator for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, president for the Sunrise Rotary Club of Champaign-Urbana, and community programs manager for the Champaign Park District. His primary areas of research and teaching are associated with social justice, leisure studies, cultural studies, and critical pedagogy. His published work has covered analyzing lynchings as violent forms of leisure, criticisms of public participation in mega event planning, such as the 2016 Olympic bid for Chicago, a critique of whiteness that dominates discourse in academic and professional fields, seeking alternative treatment programs for veterans with PTSD, perceptions of sexual orientation among college athletes, and gender equity in tourism, hospitality services. His interests and concerns are strongly centered on critiquing society for issues that are most prevalent in impacting quality of life. Rasul is also our DJ for the evening. He put together the music that you listened to on the way in tonight. And finally, Bernice Sanchez, a second-year doctoral student at Indiana University, pursuing a PhD in higher education and student affairs. A daughter of Mexican immigrants, Bernice was born and raised in Santa Ana, California. She completed her bachelor's degree in business administration from California State Polytechnic University, Pomona, and her master's degree in politics, economics, and business from Claremont Graduate University. She served as the assistant director of La Casa Cultura Latina at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign before beginning her studies. She currently serves as the managing editor for the International Journal of Qualitative Studies in Education and the assessment coordinator at the Office of Student Life and Learning at Indiana University. Her research focuses broadly on the experiences of minoritized populations within higher education, specifically looking at Latina graduate students and faculty. So that is our moderator and our panelists, and I am going to get out of the way.
I'm just wondering if these are these on? Oh, yes. I think they are now. Good evening, everyone. Okay, you're going to have to do better than that. I ask all my classes to say hello back to me, so I'm going to say good evening. So nice to see you here. I know it's near the end of a long week and a long and very busy month. And I am very, very excited to be here, really pleased to have been asked to moderate the session and be involved in this community conversation. So my job as moderator is to moderate a few different things, questions from you when that becomes relevant and timely, making sure that our participants stay on time. Unfortunately, that's one small part of it as well. But also, I have come prepared with a few advanced questions once they finish their own individual presentations, perhaps to sort of spur a little dialogue amongst ourselves and to help get you ready to start asking your questions. We really want to make sure that we leave enough time for dialogue this evening and not just be sitting up here talking at you, because that's definitely not what we want. It really needs to be a conversation. So just to probably, I have a few opening remarks. Doug said that I get to do that. So I said, okay, great. And since we're focusing on the local here tonight, you know, most of the activism work that I do is a blend of the two, but certainly focuses a lot on the national scene and how that relates to what's happening here in Bloomington. And I remember thinking when Jen and Doug both approached me about being a part of this session, thinking back to 2005 when I was interviewing for a job here at IU. And being told repeatedly over the 3 days that I was here that this is a very, very diverse place. It's really super welcoming. It's very liberal. It's a blue pond in a red sea, Indiana being the Red Sea, I guess, apparently, that there was really no sort of troubles here in terms of racism or racialized issues. I see people already just shaking their heads at me. I'm just telling you what was told to me when I was here visiting. I had never been to Indiana. I'd never been here. And so this was, you know, I mean, obviously they're trying to get me to take a job, right? And in fact, one of the things that kept coming up over and over again is that, oh, no, this is not a racist place, but there's that racist town, you know, Martinsville, right? And that was the kind of, it had a familiar ring to my ear because everywhere I've lived or traveled or been in my life, people always say, oh, no, we are the exception to the rule. You need to, I mean, there's that place over there, that town, that state. So, you know, the Canadians, you know, I grew up in Canada. The Canadians saying, oh, racism, that's that U.S. thing down there. The Northerners saying, oh, that's that thing down in the South, Alabama, Mississippi, you know, not here in New Jersey or New York. You know, you come to Indiana and it's, oh, well, no, it's not here in Bloomington, it's Martinsville. There's always this deflection, this uncomfortable realization that really there's a lot going on here, but we don't want to talk about it. It's uncomfortable, and therefore it's easier to deflect it and place it on some other person or place. And you can write that large for the nation, or you can take it right down to the individual. It's not me, it's my dad, my uncle, that horrible cousin that I don't like to talk to at Thanksgiving. Right, so you can take it all the way from the big down to the small. And when I moved here, I mean, I've been here now for almost 12 years. When I moved here and I started to see on a daily basis the kinds of racialized incidences that happen here, and of course, realizing very quickly that, you know, there is racism here. It just maybe looks a little bit different than it does in other places. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it doesn't look very different at all. It's my graduate student who is walking down Kirkwood Avenue, and she's African-American, with her white husband, and a pickup truck rolls by with a group of young white men inside who holler the N-word with the word lover attached to it at the end of it, being directed at her white husband who's walking down the street holding her hand. It's one of my undergraduate students who's a white woman going to Walmart with her black boyfriend and being glared at and people muttering things under their breath or even directly to them when they're in the store, and her getting heated and wanting to respond and her black boyfriend saying, you know, you got to keep it under control. I've been dealing with this my whole life. We just, you know, laugh it off, leave, you know, just kind of trying to keep the peace. And then when I relay those kinds of stories to people, the response often being, oh, well, maybe those things happen, but it's a townie thing. That academic university community trying to say that this is something that happens over on the west side or with these local folks. I'm like, really? There's that town-gown divide rearing its ugly head in some really strange ways because, boy, oh, boy, we want to talk about racism on the university campus. We can do that, right? We can do that. It's my next-door neighbors who are the best-intentioned people, older, white, liberals, you know, practicing Buddhists, love everybody and everything, telling me, like, you know, really seriously, racism is dying out. Racism is dying out amongst this younger generation. They have 4 children, the youngest of whom is in his early 20s. See, if you look at our youngest son and his friends, color doesn't matter to them. Race doesn't matter to them. You know, they love everybody. And, you know, this stuff is all dying out, thankfully. I'm so thankful that our kids are going to be the ones who change this. And I think to myself, really? It's dying out amongst the youth, is it? So what about the traditionalist youth network? established on our campus, you know, which came out in full force with all of their friends when Tim Wise came to visit this campus a couple of years ago, which resulted in not just name calling but fights and physicality and arrests. It's dying out amongst the youth. What about the Joseph Smedley case, where an IU freshman died last year? One of our very few black IU freshmen died last year, and his fraternity brothers didn't, you know, bother to report him missing. Nobody really seemed to think that there was anything to be worried about. It was only because his sister pressured administrative officials on campus and continues to pressure them and the local police today that the case continues to be, you know, they can't just close it and walk away. The temptation to either make black people hyper-visible as thugs and deviants or invisible when they are being killed or when they are suffering or experiencing pain. No division or hostility on our campus or in our town. What about when students exercise their First Amendment rights to protest, peacefully protest, on Columbus Day? And no one talks about the reason that they're out protesting, but it's really discomforting to people that they're being asked to, you know, redirect themselves in terms of traffic. It's going to take them 5 extra minutes to get somewhere in town. And one gentleman decided that even though the protesters were peaceful, saying please and thank you, and we can even redirect you, you know, he decided that it would be okay to put his foot on the gas and try to drive through a group of peaceful protesters. And the comments that followed the news articles, the HT's reporting on this, in my opinion, was shameful. And in terms of the protesters being described as rioters and looters and aggressive and angry and dangerous, and then the trolling comments that followed those news stories where, well, they were in the road, so they should expect to get run over. And, you know, how about I come down there and I'll run them over? And all kinds of other things about peaceful protesters, people exercising their First Amendment rights, not to mention the ongoing saga at our local high schools about the Confederate flag issue, which came to a head not for the first time and maybe not even for the last time yesterday. How many of you know what happened with that? Oh, well, okay, many of you do. But I wonder if you know that the resurrection of that flag last week in the escalated situations was a direct result, an attack on the LGBTQ students at that school. That flag has been dragged out and used to terrorize and intimidate black people since Brown v. Board happened in 54, and it was dragged out directly in retaliation to the success of the civil rights movements to terrorize and intimidate. And then last week, because conservative, quote unquote, students felt appalled and oppressed by the fact that LGBTQ students and their straight allies were wearing rainbow stickers on their t-shirts or on their backpacks, they said, well, if you can wear your flag, we can wear ours. And it escalated to the point until we see the result of it yesterday. Students and faculty at Bloomington North walking out, going to the superintendent and saying, we don't feel safe, we don't feel welcome. This is a hostile learning environment. And the superintendent finally coming down and saying, enough, line in the sand. Nobody can wear or display that flag at school or at any school events or sponsored events or, you know, anything like that from this point forward. Bloomington South actually passed a similar law years ago after an actual physical incident occurred. So all of these things which make me think when my neighbors say, oh, the youth, it's dying out amongst the youth. I'm like, really? We need to confront and converse about the fact that it is here. It is here because we live in America. It is here because America has institutionalized structural racism. This is not a gown issue. This is not a town issue. This is a human issue, and every single person who lives in this country is responsible for talking about it, because if you're not talking about it and actively working to dismantle it, your silence is complicity and it's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. It's part of the problem. So it is our issue. We all live here. This is our home. This is our community. Many of us are parents and we have children who go to school here. We are neighbors. We are colleagues. We are friends. We need to have a conversation. And that's why I'm so glad that this is happening and happening here at the town's public library. Because you know what? It's not a town. It's not a gown. This is everybody's library, right? This is the kind of space where we need to come together and have these conversations. So I, at this point, am going to stop my introductory remarks. I really appreciate you listening to me. But I hope that my focus on the local sets the scene for what our four panelists are going to discuss and what we will hear from you as the evening continues. Thank you so much. Who's going first, ladies and gentlemen? Should we, you know, draw names or?
What's the question?
Well, I think some people have already come with prepared remarks, and I'd like, based on, I believe Doug had asked some preliminary remarks in advance of everyone, so I'd like to give people a chance to respond to those before I initiate with my questions. So, Jen, do you want to go? We can just go from left to right.
Sure.
Or my left to right, anyway.
Good evening. Thank you.
Good evening.
All right. So I've been interested in issues of racism for a long time. As was mentioned, I come from the Bay Area, a much more diverse area. And so I'm more accustomed to being in kind of a more shared space. And I think that background gave me some entry into this dialogue that, you know, maybe somebody who lives in a more homogenous community wouldn't have the benefit of. But that said, I wasn't doing much. I really felt that there was a problem, like really felt it. And I bet there are people in the audience who know what I'm talking about, where you get charged up and you hear something and you're aghast. And then you go and make dinner, or you go and meet your friend, or you go and do the laundry. And so that had sort of been percolating for me for quite some time. A turning point for me was a book, Michelle Alexander's book,
New Jim Crow.
The New Jim Crow. And there's the subtitle. I'm a little nervous, so I'm gonna look at some notes and bear with me on that. The book essentially talks about sort of the notion that we look at Jim Crow, we look at slavery as though this was our past legacy of racial injustice, and we celebrate, in many ways, rightly so, our legacy of civil rights that happened in the 60s. And there are many people from that era and beyond that deserve to be celebrated. And I was one of those people who thought, wow, I'm glad we're past that. And this book in particular, it shocked me. And I was resistant to the hypothesis of this book, that there had been, through mass incarceration, a continuation of Jim Crow and really of disenfranchisement based on racial lines. And I remember when I first heard about the book and I thought, no way. What? I can't believe that. And interestingly, the author in the book talks about having the same experience. So that book really got me thinking in a new way. Still didn't really do much, though. You know, still kind of having these conversations amongst my like-minded friends, really active Facebooker, lots of likes, lots of comments. And then, of course, over the last couple of years, we've all been confronted by a reality that if you are white, I think has been easy to ignore and to not see. And I felt compelled to finally try and do something, which is what led me to one day look at the website for Showing Up for Racial Justice. There wasn't a local chapter, and so me and another gal who was unknown to me at the time just started meeting. And it's been fledgling. You know, I don't sit at this table because I'm an expert. I'm sitting at this table because I felt called to action, and I'm trying to figure out what that looks like. So I'm really pleased to be a part of a dialogue like this because, you know, Amrita mentioned that idea of, you know, people, her neighbors, and I think that this is a common sentiment that gets expressed in Bloomington of, isn't it great to live in this progressive oasis and really not seeing some of the problems that still exist? So I think that white people, this is my opinion, that white people really, we need to get involved in a different way. We need to relearn history. We need to unlearn the history that's been taught to us that has served this narrative that criminalizes people of color, that so often depicts people of color as thugs, as criminals, as happy to be in a subservient place, and that so often situates white people in positions of authority and sort of as the normative centerpiece, the cornerstone. So that's what has led me to be sitting at this table and to be involved in this conversation. So it's a privilege to be here, and I think that's all I'll say to start.
Thanks, Jen. Russell, you're up next.
I am up next. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
That's more like it, yes. All right. So I think what you may have been referring to in terms of sort of opening up is our email communication. So in preparation for this, we sort of shared with each other some of our backgrounds and the reasons for why we're here at this particular point. Mm-hmm. And so, I think first for me, I'm here because of a fulfillment and agreement that I've made with the Interchange producer. Thanks, Doug. But out of all seriousness, so we, you know, over the exchange of doing work, you start developing relationships with people. And when people ask of you certain favors or things, it's part of the work. And so the idea to continue to have some type of community and dialogue beyond the show was important. And I think that's also something to reference in thinking mm-hmm. about activism is that mm-hmm. we're there to give of ourselves of service. And yes. If we don't have another commitment to make, then we are seeking a commitment to have. Mm. So I'm here because of that. And so in coming here and being here to fulfill that sort of sense of commitment, I had to think about, well, then how do I sort of frame some of the things I will probably respond to? And so one of the things is that, you know, this particular current environment that we're in is very hard for us to think, right? And I'm not saying in relationship to particular positions that people have in the media that are running for office, but more so the sense that information is readily accessible to us. So we don't ever take the time to actually digest it. We're consuming it, right, such a rapid rate. And so, I mean, many of us here, you know, I'm sure, you know, click, right? We click on to articles, we see the title, and we probably don't even click on, and we just quickly post, mm-hmm. right? And people like it and comment or follow it or tweet it or whatever else, but we don't take time to sit there. And similar to the moderator, I love to be in archives. So I love to sit with materials for hours, days, weeks,
and digest.
Yeah. And so that sense of study allows us to sort of sit back and reflect a little bit more to discern, is this information accurate? Is it useful? How could it be useful? Is it useful for something that's now? Is it useful for something that's later? And so that's one thing I mean about the current environment is that information is so readily accessible. We're passing so much information on, and we're not being able to digest it. And what does that mean, right? Especially in relationship to some of the issues that we see in relationship to the call for Black Lives Matter. Mm. But then also just the mundaneness of the election, right? Mm. You know, in the sense that issues that are impacting lives mm-hmm. are never part of the actual discussions of things. And so when we're seeking sort of a sense of what should happen, what could happen, we're not getting that particular answer. And we're diverted to some other sort of conversation, and we're satisfied with that other conversation. So that is the current environment, and that current environment concerns me because it doesn't allow us to really see or to think. Mm. But lastly, I think a lot of our conversations as it relates to race or racism, and when I say or, I'm not saying that they're interchangeable at all, just more so trying to make the distinction that they're two separate, at least for me, two separate constructs, mm-hmm. that we always ground them in present day sort of examples and discussions. Newer texts, newer examples of situations that may occur when we have plenty of examples of these conversations that have taken place all the way to 1890s, 1880s. And there may be some value in sort of looking at that history, as you mentioned, Jennifer, in the sense that there's something that maybe in that history that can sort of give us a better insight because the sort of time that it took for people to process and sort of build the arguments that they sort of presented then. And so, at least for me, you know, when we think about Bloomington, as I was recruited here and was explained, and I did not drink that Kool-Aid. I live in Indianapolis. I live in Indianapolis. Not to say that's much better, but at least it's...
I just don't like to commute. That's why
I live. I was like, nah, it's not progressive, nah. But Bloomington is deemed progressive, mm-hmm. but is it really just simply a more nuanced version of the status quo?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then really, what is progressivism in the heart of it? So one thing that I'll probably try to react to, and you'll hear in my responses to any of your questions or points, is a move away from talking about privilege and more so talking about power.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, power is the ability to determine one's reality. Who has that? You know, power to me is making one's thought reality, which is amazing, right? It's
power
amazing,
to
right?
Yep.
You know, to conceive of anything and make it happen, that's mm-hmm. that's incredible. And the ability to exert one's will.
Mm-hmm.
This is what power is to me, and I think conversations around power allows for us to have those types of conversations as opposed to just a sense of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Privilege is what we enjoy after that will has been enacted to me. So at least that is, so that's my opening just thoughts. Again, you'll have a sense of why or how I may react to your questions or our questions up here. Thank you.
Thanks, Rasul. Berenice.
Buenas noches.
Buenas noches.
So I was very hesitant to join the panel, and for those who don't know me, know that I don't like to do public speaking, but I've been in Bloomington for about 15 months, and I think I got the same, it's a blue dot and a red state, and I mean, I ended up getting funding, so, you know, I was going to come to Bloomington, and I was committed, but I've been having these conversations with some of my close friends since moving to Bloomington about feeling this sense of invisibility. As a Latina, both on campus and within the community, and just having these reflections, and I have it with my roommate all the time about, like, the black-white binary is real and alive and kicking here. And so trying to figure out how do I fit into that narrative and into that binary as a, you know, as a community member in Bloomington and as a student in the classroom. And so I think that I finally got to the point where I'm like, okay, if I'm saying that I'm feeling invisible and I'm having this opportunity, then I really need to take advantage and take it. And so... I think for me, and I'll make my comments really short, I think that as I'm thinking about this idea of, like, race and racism within this community, and I think that lately I've been thinking and reflecting a lot more about it, not just in the current context, but really thinking back of, like, even just the history of the land that we're in, like, going back to the indigenous roots, and, like, above all else, initially we are in this land that was stolen from this people that now is not even mentioned within these conversations of race and racism within the community. And what does that mean, that these communities have been destroyed and eliminated through genocide for us to be in this place? And so I think a lot about that. And then I think my other point would be, I think the use of language to me is really big. And so, like Rasul was saying, he doesn't use privilege, he uses power. I don't use privilege, I use white supremacy. I think that we need to go to the initial root of the issue. And so I think that for me, in all of these conversations, we need to talk about race and racism, but we also need to talk about white supremacy, and we need to talk about the patriarchy, and we need to talk about imperialism and capitalism and how they all really interplay to cause the injustices and the oppression of people in communities. And then I think lastly for me, I think that it's great that people are willing to have these conversations, and I encourage people to have these conversations. But I think that in having these conversations too, we need to be very mindful of not rushing into finding solutions. And I know I was talking to Russell and sharing with him about, I think that sometimes people just need to sit with the uncomfortableness of the conversation, because it's going to be really uncomfortable and it's going to be really challenging and hard. And sometimes we do just need to sit with those feelings of being uncomfortable, of being challenged, of being sad and frustrated, and just sit in our emotions before we jump into trying to find solutions. Because I think that jumping into the solutions too quickly without fully understanding what's going on and the history behind it and all of the intricacies and all of the connections of the histories of people that are being impacted, it's going to end up just being a Band-Aid and not make any systemic change and structural change, which is really what is needed to make it sustainable. So I'll stop with that.
Thank you. William, you're up.
Well, I made a few notes about what I might try to say here. But unlike my colleagues here, I am a child of Southern Indiana. So I was born in Southern Indiana of a white mother and a black father. So my perspective is very different. And I have people on both sides of these discussions. And I understand how much relationship building is really a big part of this. My hermeneutics here is very different. You know, I work with these poor white people. I go into their trailer homes. I see them with their Confederate flags up. I have to work with them, and I sort of get a sense of not trying to defend them or anything else, but I get a sense of the poverty that we deal with when we talk about going to Martinsville, when we go to Spencer, when we go to Bedford. And we may criticize Bloomington, but this conversation is not taking place in Martinsville or Spencer or any of these towns in Nashville, nowhere else. It's taking place right here in Bloomington. I was a missionary for 5 years in Mexico and Guatemala, and those conversations don't take place there, too. So we got something special here. We may criticize what we have, and that's our right, and that's the beauty of being here. We have the opportunity to be on interchange and to try to make this better, and we have this opportunity. So I'm very happy to be here, too. Also part of my hermeneutics, and I'm going to calm down. I got these red glasses on because I have this white stepchild, and I've been spending the last couple weeks explaining. Actually, I explain black history to him all the time. And I think this is a large part of where I believe there's a problem. I think that when we look at the late Elie Wiesel in the Jewish community, you know, and his motto, never let them forget, I think what happens in the black community and maybe just in America in general is we forget. With all the information my brother's talking about, it's easy to have this tidal wave of information that makes us forget what went on. And I was telling my stepson the other day, we were looking at this poster I have of Lee Evans and John Carlos standing up in 1968 in Mexico. And I was about 12 years old at that time. And I can tell you at that time, in July of 1968, when them two brothers stood up with Black Power, I knew Black Lives Mattered. I knew it right then, Black Lives Mattered. And I think every black boy in the United States was crying at that moment. I know I was. And so I know that there are so many opportunities, so many times in the United States history when the United States said black lives did not matter. You know, Dred Scott said black lives did not matter. Signing the Constitution with three-fifths of a man or a black person says black lives did not matter. Jim Crow said black lives did not matter. Then we turn that around. Martin Luther King says black lives do matter. Malcolm X says black lives do matter. Bobby Seale says black lives do matter. But it can get forgotten unless people stand up and say black lives matter. And so that's me. That's what I have to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Just start.
I got more.
You have, if you want to, you don't have to stop. You still have time.
You know, I didn't want to keep going on, but I get this great joy. You know, I have this white stepson, and he says, "Whoa, really?" And you know, I show him this stuff, and we have this library and these posters and all these things I share with him. But you know, he is really sort of captivated by Colin Kaepernick. And, you know, he's, you know, and this whole thing that Colin Kaepernick was started out. Now, if people on Facebook, when Colin Kaepernick started doing his thing, you know, everybody was jumping on him and all. But that has sustained. And, you know, and not only that, but it has expanded to high schools and different. And you know, the white lady, the bi woman on the soccer team. I mean, there are many, many people starting to bow. They're trying to figure out in the NBA what you're going to do when they start bowing in the NBA, because it's coming too. So anyway, you know, it's just, I think part of the solution, if there is a solution, is having dialogues like this. And I think we can be pleased that we can have this dialogue here, because it ain't going on in Martinsville. You know, I tried to start an NAACP in Martinsville. They told me, good luck. You ain't going to find no brothers here. I said, well, shoot, you know, so, but we can do that here. We do have that here, right? We do have that opportunity to have the dialogue here. I think that's about all I got to say. I'm ready for questions. Yeah.
Okay, well, in the interest of making sure that we leave enough time for audience questions, I think perhaps I will try to limit my own for that reason, just looking at the time that we have. You know, all four of you touched on, well, certain things that were different, but I think also there were some themes that resonated, right? Jen, that you were talking about sort of what brings you to this place, like how did you end up here, not just here in Bloomington, but here in terms of feeling like you needed to do more, right? And Russell, I mean, there were several things you said that really resonated with me as a historian. You know, I'm always sort of tearing my hair out about the fact that people think that what's happening is new. Mm-hmm. No, the only thing that's new is that we now have cell phone camera technology, ladies and gentlemen, right? I mean, Amadou Diallo happened, Emmett Till happened, right? I mean, we can continue to go back. We can talk, go all the way. We can talk about the lynchings, spectacles, and people who gathered with their children in their Sunday best, with their alcohol and their food, and taking photographs, which they turned into picture postcards, right? And, you know, transmitted throughout the country saying, we had a barbecue here last week, and there were dead black bodies hanging on the front of that postcard. Right, and then they were fighting over finger and toe bones to take home as you know, souvenirs, you know. So this is not new, right? This is not new. And I think about Berenice saying, "Let's not jump to try to come up with a solution." And I was thinking to myself, "Oh, but one of my questions was," but it's not exactly a solution per se. But it was kind of along those lines about, and then William ends us with, "Well, we are having a dialogue, and this is a good thing." Mm-hmm. So I'm like putting all these things together, and I'm thinking, okay, we are here because we, the people in this room, are here because clearly we feel like there's a problem. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, mm-hmm. right? That we want to do something, the same something that drove Jen to eventually help co-found the Bloomington chapter, along with Beth, if I'm not mistaken, who's sitting here in the front nodding at me, right? That Beth Applegate, right? Mm-hmm. And Jen are the co-chairs and co-founders of this Bloomington Surge chapter. So something led Jen to that, and it's the same something that has brought all of us here, right? Well, that something is the fact that it is white supremacy. It is about power. Boy, let me tell you one thing that I hate more than the word white privilege: implicit bias. Mm-hmm. Is there really a lot of people in the U.S. today still who honestly can say that they are completely unconscious and unaware, and that it's implicit, and they're just not.
I think there's something
they don't understand.
Those things that's out there. There's anger.
Oh,
there's anger.
I never forget that.
Yeah, and well, it's so important.
I never forget that.
And that's amongst all the races. All of them are angry. The Hispanics are angry. The blacks are angry. The whites are angry. Everybody's angry because they feel like we have a system that's broken. And everybody's getting treated unfairly.
Well, so. I don't think it's broken at all. I think it's functioning exactly the way it was meant to.
Mm. Yes. Mm.
It was created to keep white people in power. Mm-hmm. It's a system of white supremacy. So I don't think it's broken. No. Not one little bit. No. I think the anger is being created from the fact that people are tired of that system being in place. Yeah. On the one side, and on the other side, we got a bunch of people who are trying frantically to keep that system in place. Mm. So, ooh, yeah, there's a lot of anger. That's a lot of anger.
People that vote against their own interests that I don't even think they're consciously trying to keep the system in place. I think they're getting finagled by others who recruit them, much like they did, I mean, just through the Civil War, through all the wars. I mean, it's the poor who fight the wars. So I think that
it's the same way. It's the same way that the one percenters in the antebellum South managed to keep all the poor whites in favor of slavery, even though it actually didn't benefit them.
So our challenge would then be let's try to find a way to identify that 1%, and let's see if we can do a better job of attacking them. When I talk to people about insurance companies are ripping us off, and all these institutions are ripping us off, and the people who are getting ripped off are all of you, and especially all the poor people, white, black, Hispanic, whatever, and they're all angry. I work with them all the time. I don't read about them. I work with them.